This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, we're going to start so we can get you guys out of here and Josh can get back to LA. So Josh Jacobs is here with us today. He is the global CEO of Acuen Media. I just want to say about Josh, you get to my point in or you get to the point I am in my career right now, I can kind of pick and choose who I want to work with to some extent, to a large extent. And I love working with Josh. We're on a board together. We're on Invoca's board, which is Ring Revenue. Jason Spivak, some of you guys are familiar with Jason. It's just been great for me to sit on a board with Josh and learn. I always walk out of the meeting learning from him. He sees the world through a very different set of eyes than I do, and his insights are fantastic. So when I asked him to speak, I knew it was a little bit of a burden. He's literally travels all over the world. He was just telling me that he was in London and Hong Kong in the same week, which may sound incredibly glamorous. I can tell you it's incredibly painful. It is like our version of hell on this planet. It's not fun at all. So he's traveling a lot, but he was able to mark this day off a couple months ago, and he was able to hold it for us, which is fantastic, and I'm very, very appreciative of that. Very quickly give you a feel for his background. So Acuen Media is Omnicom's programmatic media buying platform. What the hell does that mean? Listen, I invest in this space, and even I get confused by it. The ads that you see on the internet, by and large at this point, are being bought and sold automatically. People put in bids for certain types of demographics they're looking for, certain times of day, certain sites, et cetera, and it's programmatic buying. It's happening in milliseconds. And Josh is one of the leaders in that space. It's a growing space. It's really followed the same evolution that stocks have followed. So you know how stocks on Wall Street are traded primarily by computers? That's now how display ads and soon every kind of ad online is being bought and sold. Prior to Acuen, Josh was the Senior Vice President of Advertising Products and Global Marketing at Glam Media, a very successful company. Before he joined Glam, he was Yahoo's VP and General Manager of Marketing Technology, where he did a number of things, including headed up their publisher network display partnership program. He was also the General Manager of Right Media Exchange, so wore a lot of hats there at Yahoo. Before Yahoo, he was president of a privately held software company called X1, which we were just talking about before class. The product is still out there, still delivering a lot of value. Searching on the desktop, making search easier on your desktop. He was a senior executive at several early internet media startup companies before X1, including Big Step, where he was a co-founder. I think we'll probably hear a little bit about Big Step. He began his career as a software engineer, where he led development teams for several award-winning consumer products, including NetObject's Fusion product. So diversified career, comes from a technical background, and now finds himself at the head of one of the biggest media organizations in the world. I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Let's welcome him to our class.
Well, first of all, thanks. I appreciate everyone coming out to listen tonight and appreciate the invitation. It's the best description I've ever heard of what I do. I usually just say I'm the creepy guy that follows you around the internet. So we'll keep it simple from there. So I didn't really know what to do when John asked me to present. I had a very, very weird career. As he said, I was a software engineer for a long time. Background pretty strange. And as you know, as I was thinking about it, what became sort of the most interesting thing to me to talk about was I've actually, despite all the sort of glowing accolades, had a lot of different setbacks all the way along the way. And I thought it would be a lot more interesting to sort of get up and tell the story of what are sort of some of the things that have happened to me along the way that have got me to the place that I'm at today, which means I fly around the world and sit in way too many cities. The sort of starting point here, I think, and I started with this because I think everybody who's in this class or who's in here for extra credit, if you're taking an entrepreneurship class, you're at least thinking about, on some level, I want to do something different. I don't want to just go get that job at the law firm and work my way up the ladder for the next 40 years and get to be partner eventually, and hopefully then I can play golf. You're presumably, there's an idea out there that maybe I can do something a little bit different in my career, and I was definitely that kid. And the hair goes quickly, but the ideas overall don't really change. And for me, the sort of starting animating thing in a lot of ways was I graduated high school. I was really, really young. I hated school. I wanted nothing to do with it. And immediately sort of took this other path and said, I'm not going to college. I'm going to go do something else with my life. And I got a huge job as a delivery driver for an art store. And off I went to go begin my career. And I got really, really lucky in a variety of different ways. But the guy who ran the art store liked me, thought I was smart, and started giving me opportunities to take on more stuff. And I ended up managing the store after a couple of years. And one of the things that happened during that time is we bought a business that was... I don't even know if anybody in here will remember this, but back when Macintoshes first came out, we had this thing called desktop publishing, and you would go in with your floppy disk into somebody else's business and pay to use their laser printer. Great business, super lucrative. And I learned how to use Macintosh, which turned out to be a really good thing, because through that, I met a bunch of people who worked at Apple. And the this led to this very interesting, I guess, conundrum for me. I was bored at the art store, wanted to be doing more, was having fun playing with computers and learning more about that, but was working at an art store and really didn't know what I was going to do next. And I had a couple of friends who were working at Apple who were coming home and telling me these stories about beer bashes every Friday and all this great fun, and there were video games in the office. And I had another couple of friends who, one of their aunts owned a video store. And again, I'm going to keep dating myself here. Video stores are places where you used to go rent videos. We had jobs waiting for us in Austin. All we had to do was pick up and move ourselves to Austin, and we could be clerks. And the so I decided I got to change something in my life. I have to take this step forward. I'm either moving to Austin and getting this job at a video store, or I'm getting a job at Apple. And I drew a line in the sand and said, on this Monday, if I don't have a job at Apple, I'm moving to Texas. So it gets closer and closer, and got new tires on the car and everything I own in boxes, and I'm ready to leave. And I got hired at Apple on Friday afternoon right before that deadline. And again, it's one of these sort of, you know, I'm sure there's an alternative life Josh out there somewhere in Texas drinking beer, driving a pickup truck, and still working at a video store. But working at Netflix, maybe. So I got really, really lucky there. And you're going to hear that theme, I think, over and over again as I talk through this, that you know, I'm not sure if it's being lucky, being in the right place at the right time, or raising my hand a lot and saying, I'd like to try that. But throughout the, you know, the whole early part of my career, there's sort of story after story of getting lucky, getting into a situation where I had an opportunity to do way more than I was qualified to do, and sort of trying to take advantage of that opportunity. So I started learning a whole bunch of things. This is the first inkjet printer that shipped with TrueType. Again, I'm going to just keep coming with the things you've never heard of. Back in the day, it was actually $5,000 to buy a printer that could print out text that looked good. And this was the first printer that could print type for a few hundred dollars. And I worked on this at Apple. I was the lowest level QA engineer in the world. And what that basically meant is I sat in a room full of every single model of computer that Apple had ever come out with every software program you can imagine, and pressed print all day long, and then looked at the paper that came out of the printer and said, does this look like what it's supposed to look like? And if not, tried to figure out why the hell the printer wasn't printing what was on the screen, and wrote up bugs into our database and the rest of this. So it was a very glamorous job. And along the way, we got to this point. This was, interestingly enough, for as low level as my role in this whole thing was, for Apple, this was actually an incredibly critical project. We were shipping TrueType was about the first time that Apple tried to sort of sever their relationship from Adobe and stand on their own two feet with imaging. And so it was getting a lot of attention at the senior most levels of the organization. So we'd planned to ship this thing on a worldwide basis, which meant that you had to manufacture floppy disks with the software, and you had to get stuff into boxes, and you had to build all the printers, and you had to position them around the world so that it was available on day one, and and all the rest. It's a fairly complicated thing to actually ship 100,000 or a million units all over the globe. So 2 weeks before we're supposed to go on sale, we find this pretty brutal bug. And basically what this does is it crashes your computer and you lose all your work, and it's not a good thing. So we get whisked off to Cupertino, to the big meeting room where all of the very senior folks who run software are, and we give this little report, and we explain, like, we're screwed. Dude, there's a bug. We can't ship this. And Sheila Brady, who's running the operating system at Apple at the time, says, well, we have to start duplicating disks tomorrow in order to be able to make the manufacturing round. And my boss is sitting there in the room with me, and I actually still had the dreadlocks, barefoot, and all the rest of it. I have no idea why they brought me to this meeting, but the my boss says, well, every time we do a new release of the software, we have to have 2 weeks to do a full test cycle on it, so there's no way we can make this thing tomorrow. And they're going back and forth, and it's this really, really stupid, we have to ship, we need 2 weeks, we have to ship, we need 2 weeks. And there's no sort of end in sight. And at some point, I raised my hand and I said, I've been working all day with the engineers on this. We have a fix. I've tested it. I know where the fix is. I think it's pretty innocuous. What if we took a chance, started duplicating disks with the fix in it? We'll stay up all weekend, try to accelerate the test pass, get it done as quickly as we possibly can. Worst case scenario, we're out a whole bunch of floppy disks. Best case scenario, we make the launch date. And Sheila jumps all over this, right? You know, someone just bailed her out, basically, and it was the QA guy who bailed her out, no less. So she's thrilled. And my boss sits there all quietly, and we leave the building. We go back. I stay up all weekend testing the software. And meanwhile, my boss is back in his cube banging out these flame emails to anybody who will listen about how Sheila had crammed this down our throat, and nobody respects QA, and on and on and on. And it was the strangest thing in the world to me. And it was really one of the very first lessons that I got in working in the corporate world, was that, not maybe surprising, but it really was to me, that I didn't get how we didn't all want the same thing. You know, that we all had an Apple on our paycheck. We all should be trying to do the best thing for the company. This seemed like a practical solution that was a good thing. And it was terrible. It was the worst thing that I could have done for my organization, because for my organization, it somehow made us look less powerful because we couldn't stop the train in finding a bug. So it was really, really eye-opening to me that, just doing the right thing, showing up, being good, rowing in the right direction, whatever sort of metaphor you want to use, wasn't always going to be the best thing for my career. And it was a hard lesson to learn. But then I left Apple and I went to a company called Go. And how many people have iPads? Okay. That is a pen computer from 1992. You see the bezel on that is probably the size of the whole iPad today. You could write on these things and they'd recognize your handwriting and whatever else. And so Go made the first consumer-oriented pen operating system that predated Palm and all of the other kind of PDAs today. And they were these big, gigantic, clunky computers. And it was a really interesting startup with some of the most amazing talent in the Valley at the time. And I ran into a second lesson working there. I'm still doing QA, only now instead of printing things out, I'm sitting here writing words on the screen and seeing if it can recognize them and all the rest. And we have to do a huge demo for a bunch of investors. And the software doesn't work. There's, this early, early days. But Robert, the guy here that you see, who's our VP of engineering, is going to have to get up in front of this room full of investors and give this presentation and show them that our idea works. So I get assigned to write the script for his demo, which effectively means figure out some path to show some aspect of this thing that won't crash when he goes to demo it. So, okay. That's fine. So I write a little script and I start QAing it and find where it crashes and bring the engineers over and we fix bugs and whatever. And I'm working on this thing around the clock. And the morning of the big presentation rolls around, and I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I drove up there early, and I had three of those bricks in my bag so I could make sure if one was broken, you know, another one would be able to work. And we get up there, and Robert does this thing. I pull him aside beforehand, you know, and literally say, if you deviate from my script by an inch, you're dead, right? The software will not work. So he gets through the demo. Whole thing goes perfectly, doesn't crash. I haven't slept in 3 days. All I want to do is go home and go to sleep. And I'm sitting there. I'm like wearing, you know, jeans and a T-shirt and all bedraggled. Everybody else in the room is wearing suits, you know, big, big high-power finance guys. And I'm walking out of the room, and Bill Campbell, who's our CEO, grabs me, pulls me over into this group of investors that are sitting there talking, and he says, this is the guy that made the whole thing happen. And, you know, you just destroyed. I've been telling that story, I mean, it's 20 years ago now. I still get goosebumps because there are so few times in your life where somebody who does not have to see you sees you, recognizes you, and it changes everything about the way that you are willing to go after working for those people. And you think about Scott at Apple, the guy who basically acted like, you know, we'd had this thing crammed down our throats, and Scott ended up coming to me for a job a few years later, and I didn't hire him because Scott was an awful human being who didn't want to do the bare minimum that it took to go make the company happen. I would run through a wall for Bill Campbell to this day because the guy just recognized that you were working your ass off for him and took the time, regardless of the room that he was in, to make sure that you knew that he knew that. It was a great, great lesson. The next one, I went back to Apple. And I ended up in a really, really interesting job where they hired me to do QA. Recurring theme here. And a couple of days into it, the guy who was the lead engineer on the project that I was supposed to be testing for realized I knew as much about programming as the rest of the folks on the team, and they made me into a programmer on it instead. And what became really interesting there was that we had a bunch of really, really smart senior engineers who realized that I wanted to learn. And so they literally came up with the title work that they had to do. And it was all this stuff that was too boring for anybody who had any real experience or who had an engineering degree, and that I would jump at the chance and stay up all night to get to do because it gave me an opportunity to go learn something and the rest of it. So literally, I mean, I actually, you know, that job, 2.5 years where it began, you know, quite literally come in and be the QA guy on this authoring tool. At the end of the 2.5 years, I was leading a team designing a new version of the operating system, and it was entirely because of the fact that these guys kept giving me more rope to hang myself with. So, you know, third lesson, people are going to give you chances. Being the person who raises your hand and says, I want that opportunity, trying things out that don't necessarily fit into your wheelhouse or aren't what you know how to do. If you can find people who will give you those opportunities and teach you, and if you can let yourself be willing to get out of your comfort zone and take things on, there is literally no bounds to how quickly you can accelerate your own career and change your direction. And this was all great for me, right? I've gone from the guy who hits print to I'm managing big teams of engineers, we're working on operating systems, life is great. And then I get the next lesson. Also really, really tough. Working at a company called Black Diamond, we're a consulting company, we write software for people, and I'm now managing the whole West Coast office, and I've got all of these engineers working for me, and we're hiring them from different places, and we're putting them on projects. And this guy, David, joins us, and he wants more than anything else to be an engineering lead. That's his, you know, big sort of aspiration. He'd been an engineer, and he wanted to lead teams. And leading a team for us meant that you had to write proposals for clients, and we would, you know, we were actually, it was an interesting business. We took software that was written for PCs and ported it to the Macintosh. And so what that meant was that, you know, companies like IBM, for example, that had all sorts of custom software that they had written to run some of their big printers and things like that, had one customer that had a Mac. So they'd pay us to go write a Mac version of their software. And so generally, 30 days into a project, we would write a whole, okay, we've dug into it, we understand what's going on, here's how long it's going to take to do this. And that was part of the job of an engineering lead. And this guy, Dave, is, you know, 7 days in, and he's supposed to be starting to work on his 30-day plan, and it's not getting done, and it's 2 weeks in, and it's not getting done, and it's 3 weeks in, you know, and I haven't seen a draft of this thing, and I'm, you know, so I, you know, I start talking to him, and kind of need to see where we're at, and one day I sort of walk behind his desk and see that he's pretty much written the headline and changed the font 12 times, and that's about the extent of, you know, of where we are in this thing. And he just keeps assuring me, I got this, I got this, I got this. And it was, he didn't know how to write, right? Like the thing, at, you know, at the end of the day is he had got himself into a position where he wanted something so badly, he didn't know how to do it, he didn't know how to ask for help, and he didn't know how to say, I don't know what to do. And he just kept digging deeper and deeper and deeper into that. So the document needs to be at FedEx on, you know, whatever morning it was, at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I'm leaving at 5 o'clock the night before. I still haven't seen this thing. And it's, you know, okay, you're finishing it tonight. Email it to me. I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'll do my proofread, do my edits on it, and I'll drive it over to FedEx. So I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's the title page sitting in my inbox with the 14 changed fonts and absolutely nothing else in this document. And the, I mean, long story short, we came in, we wrote something, we got it out the door. Certainly wasn't our finest hour or the best piece of work that we'd ever produced. And this guy comes in, you know, the next day, and first of all, he wants to then work on the document, and we're just like, just go sit over there. We'll talk to you later. But he, you know, then we sat down with him afterwards, and we had this whole long talk about you need to communicate. You know, it's okay to say I can't do something. It's not okay to leave the whole team in the lurch like this, et cetera, et cetera. And we're giving you another chance. We know this is really important to you. The guy had been my friend, like I knew him from before, and 2 weeks later, with the next deadline looming, he walks into the office one day and says, I don't think you guys are ever going to trust me again, so I quit. I'm not giving you any notice, and good luck. Also fascinating, one of the hardest things that, you know, again, that I had to go through sort of early on in my career, and there was another sort of lesson, I think, in this whole thing, right, that I see this guy who looks a lot like me. He's ambitious. He's trying to take on something new that he hasn't done before. And all I want to do is see the guy succeed. And he's failing all over the place, and he's taking down everybody else with him. And I had no idea how to manage that at all. I had no idea how to deal with anybody who wasn't exactly like me. And I think it's another one of the really, really important things that you sort of start learning early on in this whole thing, that especially, and it's especially true of entrepreneurial type people, if you're used to being a superstar, if you're used to getting it the first time, if you're the person who turns in their homework without having to do a ton of work on it themselves, or the guy who leaves early at the end of class because you already got it and read the chapter, whatever, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult when you find yourself in a situation where it's not about managing yourself to do that, but now you're dealing with people who don't learn the same way that you do and don't work the same way that you do and may have the same ambitions and desires as you do, but don't have the ability to just knock it out the way that you have. And it was, you know, I still feel bad about it, and I still don't know what I would have done differently other than give him the opportunity. But it was an incredibly hard early challenge for me to figure out, how do I manage people who don't have the same sort of natural ability to move stuff forward. And so I'm doing all this learning, and I find myself at this company called NetObjects. And hated it. I don't know how else to put it. Like, I just, you know, I was miserable. And it's the biggest job, you know, that I've ever had. I'm running this huge team. I'm responsible for all Macintosh products that are coming out of this place. And, you know, I even really like a bunch of my coworkers and the rest. But I'm basically doing the same thing that I've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years, which is we have a Windows team who's writing the Windows version of the software, and my team's making it run on the Macintosh. And I had a mentor there, this guy was about 10 years older than me, named Tom Hammer. And I was out walking with him one day, and he said this thing to me that's just stuck with me ever since. And it's one of the stories I tell people all the time because I feel like it's really made a huge difference for me. And what he said is, Josh, the reason you're so angry and you're so frustrated and you're so bored is that in your life you need to go back and forth between jobs where you learn and jobs where you teach. And you've been learning for so damn long, you need a teaching job. Or maybe it was the other way around at the time, but the point that, you know, that he was trying to bring out was that you are going to go through these stages where you want to be challenged, you want to pick new things up, and then you need to cement those skills and make them your own. And so you go through these waves of I'm learning, I'm absorbing, and then you have to teach, because teaching is the process of ultimately figuring out, how do I internalize this? How do I make this a part of myself? How do I communicate this and lead other people to be able to follow those same things? And I think, as you'll see, as we sort of talk through some of the rest of the arc of my career, as it were, this starts to become this real theme of jobs where I'm way outside of my comfort zone, and then jobs where I got a chance to kind of pull all the pieces together, take the new things that I learned, and do something with them. And I would definitely, you know, encourage everybody that there are sometimes a job that may not be a huge step up or a new challenge, the challenge is actually found in being able to say, can I teach other people how to do this? And that's just as valuable. So it's the interlude. Because then I had a really funny experience. I'm working for this company that's in New York, and I'm traveling a lot. And I call my wife up one night and launch into this, you know, she says, how was your day or whatever? And I just went out to dinner at what's supposed to be this really nice restaurant, and my crab cakes came and they were cold in the middle, and the duck was dry and it wasn't very succulent. And my wife, who is sitting at home, says to me, oh, that's interesting. The cat's sick. The roof is leaking, you know, and launches into this just whole litany of very, very real world problems that she's sitting at home dealing with by herself while I'm complaining about the duck not being succulent. there's a bunch of different lessons, you know, ultimately that came from this. First of all, your wife will never forget. I hear about the succulent duck to this day. Trust me, I whine about absolutely anything. My wife looks at me and she goes, what, your duck's not succulent? I'm not allowed to complain ever again because of that episode. I think it's really, really easy when you're wound up in doing something, when you're building a company, when you're traveling around the world, all of the rest of this stuff, to just kind of forget that other people in your life are dealing with other things, and that, you know, being able to stop just seeing your cold crab cake and, you know, and remember the other people that are around you and understand and have enough sort of ability to separate yourself from that and be empathetic. Something I absolutely sucked at, and it was really, really hard to, not just be running around being full of myself. And the succulent duck thing, in a lot of ways, really is, I think it's a grounding thing for me to this day, that work is not my entire life. I have these other people in my life that matter to me that I need to make time for, and that I need to remember that the stuff that I'm working on, you know, I sell banner ads on the internet. It's not that big of a deal. We're not curing cancer. And, you know, I try to, you know, find ways all the time at this point to kind of come back to that reality of saying that despite the fact that you're running around and doing all of this crazy stuff, stop, see your family, make time for them. I get my first real chance. So I'm going to back up for a second. So when I moved down to Silicon Valley, got the job at Apple originally, the whole idea was we were going to go start our own company. Me and my friends, you know, we're just fired up. We grew up with, you know, stories about Steve and Steve at Apple and the HP people and the rest of it. And we just, you know, we wanted to go start companies. And we realized, you know, one night sitting around drinking beers and talking about the company that we wanted to start, that none of us knew how to start a company. And so, you know, I think we should have taken an entrepreneurship class, but there were no books about how to raise money. There were, you know, there was none of this stuff. We just sort of had this idea. And somehow, you know, that epiphany became, well, let's all move to the Valley, get jobs at Apple, and they'll teach us how to start companies, and then we'll be able to start companies at some point. So we did, and we all moved down there, and then Big Step came along. And Big Step was the first company that I co-founded. I had four other co-founders, and late 90s, when sort of the first phase of internet companies and all of the good and bad that goes along with that. And so we started this company, and I was the chief technology officer, and we had a pretty amazing little run. We, you know, we ended up raising almost $75 million. We built a software platform that let small business owners build their first websites and do e-commerce and online marketing and the rest of this, and built and architected this, you know, huge software system for it. How many people in the room, if any, software people in any way, shape, or form, CS majors or anything else? So I'll tell you a funny story, and everybody else can just not listen to it, but it's amusing. When we launched this little website in 1999, we did a deal with Sun Microsystems, who gave us $2.5 million worth of server hardware, which was delivered out in front of our building in flatbed trucks. And it's not that long ago. It's 15 years ago. It took $2.5 million worth of hardware and a couple of flatbed trucks to launch a website back then that we could put a couple of 100,000 customers onto, right? Now, you got a team of 11 people who launched Instagram and are, you know, running however many trillions of pictures every single, you know, day through that 15 years later. We're still rubbing sticks together back then. So I've got a bunch of things I want to talk about Big Step, because I feel like this was my dream, right? I'm almost 30 years old. I wanted to start a company more badly than anything else. I wanted to be a founder, and here I am. I'm a founder. I've got these great guys that we started this company with, and we go out to dinner every couple of weeks and have founders dinner or whatever else. And we start realizing that Andrew, who was our CEO, is not sharing everything with us. And, you know, all five of us will go to dinner, and he's kind of 4+1. And he's off in meetings that we're not in, and on and on. And it got to be this incredibly, incredibly contentious thing for us. And Andrew and I had a bunch of, you know, literally knockdown, drag-out fights where we had to leave the building and, you know, go somewhere else so we could scream at each other, and really, really, really tough. And I didn't know what was going on. I just, you know, I sort of felt like he was big-timing the rest of us because he was the CEO and the rest of us were his co-founders, and just had no idea what was going on with that. And we'll come back to that at some point. But I was also an incredibly, incredibly arrogant young punk. And so we're 2 years into this. We've raised a ton of money. That makes me probably the smartest guy in the room, because we raised all this money, and that was the metric that you cared about back then. And I got bored. I'm CTO. We've got a VP of engineering. We've got a VP of network operations. My job is like basically strategic business development at this point. I got a couple of people reporting to me, and I'm wasting time. So I decided what I was going to do is I was going to drive the expansion internationally. And I wrote a business plan for that. And my whole business plan was, because the software is already written, I can just go over there and build a sales and marketing organization and start charging and make money from it. Now, the internet back then, the strategy of an internet company was you aggregate eyeballs and you will make money later. And that was basically the entire business thesis of every single company that got created back then. So we were very much in the aggregating eyeballs phase of the development there, and we aggregated a lot of them. And our board said, if you've got all these ideas about how to make money, why don't you do that here? And do that here meant taking on the job of somebody else who was there, who we fired, who was the VP of sales and marketing. And so I went from this job where, you know, I'd literally done every single job in the engineering organization down to being the guy who QA'd print drivers to managing these four functions who were amazingly, and I absolutely kid you not, the four people who were the vice presidents heading these functions, Duke MBA, Harvard MBA, Wharton MBA, and a Haas MBA. And here comes, you know, Barefoot Josh, the engineering lead, still had dreadlocks. And I come walking into this room to supervise these four people who have, you know, forgotten more about their functions than I'm ever going to know in my entire life. And I sit down with David Rich, our VP of marketing, and I just start talking. I start telling him all the cool stuff we're going to do now that I'm in charge. And he let me talk for probably 15 minutes, and I finally paused for air, and he looks at me and he goes, "Who the f*** do you think you are?" And proceeded to tell me what a complete f***ing idiot I was, that I knew absolutely nothing about marketing, and that there was no way in hell that I could tell him anything about how to do his job. And he was absolutely right. I love this story to this day because it was by far the most difficult thing as a manager to go from being in this position where, I mean, I was a pretty decent engineer, and I'd built a pretty damn good engineering organization, and all of a sudden, I don't know how to help these guys. And so my job became very, very different. It became this incredible challenge to kind of go, how do you take people who are smarter than yourself, who know more than you know about what it is that they're doing, and add value in that kind of a situation? And it is an incredibly, incredibly interesting challenge. And I'll digress from Big Step for a minute, because I've got a guy on my team right now who's a really, really sharp technology guy. He's a product manager. And we're promoting him into a leadership role. And when we gave him the promotion, I sat down, I told him this story, and, you know, and then proceeded to say to him that he was about to go through the most difficult challenge that he had ever gone through professionally, because he's been a stud. Like, he's great at what he does. And what we said to him is, the things that have made you good at what you do are going to be the reasons that you fail in the next phase of your job. That literally the fact that you can just roll up your sleeves and do it yourself faster than the weakest link on your team is going to kill you. And it's going to be the reason I fire you from this job, because you can't figure out how to make a team perform at the level that you perform at instead. I will tell you this over and over and over again. The most success you will have in your life is when you surround yourself with people that are smarter than you. The hardest thing in the world as a manager is to figure out how the hell do you add value to a team like that. And what I figured out to some extent, because again, I don't have any illusions about how much I, you know, or how well I did or didn't do in that job. But what I figured out was that what I could do for that team is, as a founder and somebody who really, really understood the vision of the company, I could align what they were doing. I could provide them with air cover at the board of directors. I could help them to make their individual functions coherent within the overall strategy of the company. And I could give them a voice at the board of directors and management team level that they hadn't had under their previous manager, and use that to get the sales and marketing function better aligned with the engineering function. And so it became a really, really different job, where I was much more facilitating the skills of these other people and much less worried about what my individual contributions were to that. And that was really, really difficult. Another shame. Then AOL offered to buy us. I don't know what the answer to this one is either, but I think if somebody offers you $250 million and you're aggregating eyeballs and have no plan to make money, you should take the $250 million. We didn't. And I remember the dinner where we all sat around and did our personal math and decided that we needed $350 million before we could sell to AOL. So we sold it for $30 a couple of years later, but after raising $75. So you can do the math on how well I made out on that deal. Just a couple of other things, though, that I will talk about, because that process of going through a company that had grown really, really quickly, spending other people's money and offering free services. In 2000, the whole internet business kind of hit this wall, and we went from VCs throwing money at people who were aggregating more eyeballs to everyone saying you need a business model, and you need a business model overnight, and you need to get to profitability. And so I got to lead the charge to try to make Big Step profitable and to, you know, ultimately figure out how to make money. And there are a couple of, I think really, really interesting things that happen in that, both good and bad, that are things that, you know, that I think are important to think about from a leadership perspective. The first was we had 500,000 signed up customers on this platform, and we need to get them to start paying us money now. And we did something really smart that, again, I think everybody, regardless of whether you're in a technology field, a math field, or any other field of management, you can learn a lot from. We had built a data warehouse. And so we had an ability to do really, really detailed analysis of those 500,000 customers and figure out who was actually getting any value out of the platform. And sadly, for our prospects, we were able to narrow that group down to a very small number of those 500,000 people who should actually be paying us because they really were getting benefits where there was an ROI to paying us money for using our software. And so we ended up focusing on 30,000 people out of the 500 that we were convinced we could get to pay us. And we put a billing system in place to do that, et cetera. And the boiler room ended up being a big conference room on one of our empty floors. We decided that what we were going to do as a company is we were going to call all 30,000 of those people and ask for their business. And so we set up a huge room full of telephones, and every single employee in the company got a quota. The engineers got 50. The customer support people got 200. But literally all 30,000 of those names got assigned to somebody. And I moved my desk down to the boiler room, and the whole deal was come down when you have a break, come spend an hour in the morning, whatever it is you got to do, but everybody's got to come make your phone calls, and I'm going to sit here the whole time, and if somebody yells at you, if somebody's pissed off, you don't have to deal with any of the angry customers. I'll take the angry calls. You can dump all that off to me, but everyone's going to go and make these phone calls. And we did it. And we did it as a team, and we made it to profitability making phone calls and asking people for their business. And, you know, again, I think the things that I took away from that, one was that turning a huge problem into a mission for the whole company and not just saying, well, that's sales and marketing's problem. The sales guys have to go find the money. But making it into a team endeavor was really huge. From a management perspective, not making it somebody else's problem, but saying, I'm going to sit there with you, and this is my problem as much as anybody else's. I'll take the angries. I won't ask you to do something I won't do myself, was also really critical. Our people showed up, and they made the phone calls, and they believed in it, and it really did make a huge difference. And we still had to fire a whole bunch of them. And that is, without a doubt, the shittiest thing I've ever had to do in my life. So I told you I was going to talk about some of the hard parts and the sad parts. Firing your friends that you built a company with is awful. I had to fire one of my co-founders, who is to this day one of my best friends. But I had to sit down with him and say, we have to let you go. We can't keep you. We can't make it to profitability with you on payroll. And a whole bunch of other people. And one of the things about founding a company, and I think it's different than just being a manager at a company, and I think you should take it as seriously as a manager in a company as you will as a founder, but there's almost no way that the two come close. When you hire somebody, there's generally a family behind them, there's rent behind them, there's kids, there's their dreams and aspirations, there's the job they didn't take to come work for you, etc. It is the worst thing in the world. So what can you learn from that? Always be successful so that you never have to fire people. That's basically the, no. I don't even know exactly what you can learn from that other than certainly what I took away from it later. I have stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning in the middle of vacations negotiating term sheets with venture capitalists to make sure that I could make payroll. I take incredibly seriously every single job offer that I give to people because I think all the time about, do I want to fire this person? Do I want to have to go through with that? And if not, then I'm not going to make that offer to them. The way that we run Acuant today, we set a financial plan for the year. We take a lower number down from that, and we manage our operating expenses to that lower number. And we do that until such time as me and the rest of my leadership team feel so confident that we're tracking to the higher number that we're willing to commit the resources behind that. And I do that more than anything else because I think it's incredibly unfair to people when you're their boss or when you're their founder or, you know, when you're their leader. I think offering somebody a job requires a greater commitment to that than I'm taking a chance here with somebody else's life. So be thoughtful about that, I guess, as you become managers. I don't know what else I can say about it other than it really sucks to fire people. And it never stops sucking. And the last one here, fear also becomes a really, really profound issue. So when you found a company, this is your baby, and you're 2-3 years into this thing. You've got all these people around you. It's really, really hard for that not to become sort of the heart and soul of your identity and for you to feel like I've put everything that I am into this thing. And Big Step was definitely that for me. I mean, it's my dream from childhood, and we weren't making it. We were sort of watching this company that we had built fire our friends and trying really hard to get enough subscription revenue to be able to, you know, to keep the lights on. And well, maybe we can get it down to where we can run it at 100 people, or maybe it'll be 80 people, et cetera. And the phone rang. And we had a partnership, probably shouldn't name names here. We had a partnership with a very, very large internet company that offered to do a deal with us that required us to do something to help them out that was fairly unethical. And it seems so easy in hindsight, you know, to look at that and say that was the stupidest thing ever. Of course, we shouldn't have done it. And I can tell you that at the time, first of all, the feeling that I had to save the company, that I couldn't go through another layoff, was unbelievably top of mind for me. This company had also screwed us really, really badly. Like, we'd done this huge deal with them. We'd given them tens of millions of dollars as part of that deal. And this was like our way to get some of that back. And that really weighed on it. It was like part of the reason that we're going down is we don't have the cash that we gave to these guys that they didn't deliver on. And here's a way to kind of undo that. And at the end of the day, what I had to do is say I was a customer for another one of their products and backdate an invoice by 2 days. It wasn't that big of a deal, and I could save my company. So I did it. And when the FBI called me 3-4 years later, and I spent all my retirement money paying a former U.S. attorney to defend me and get me immunity and testified in front of a grand jury to send these other guys to jail for it, I felt really stupid about it after the fact. What's the lesson here? This was my baby, and I really would have done anything to save it. And fear makes you do really, really stupid, screwed up things. And I'm going to get to some other ones, but I think, you know, maybe the only lesson in this whole thing is that at the end of the day, it's a company. And they really matter, and they're really, it's an amazing experience. And at the end of the day, it's a company, and you can't lose yourself and your integrity and your ethics over trying to save a company, because at the end of the day, it's just a company and you have to still walk away from it. So, staring my prison cell in the in the eyes and trying to figure out what to do next, you know, we wound the company down to about 35-40 people, got enough subscription revenue up that we were able to operate the business profitably and start working on selling it. And we were able to sell it to a larger internet service provider and, got some of the money back for our investors and learned a hell of a lot along the way. And I find myself now having lived my dream and trying to figure out what am I supposed to do next with my life. And got some really good advice and interesting advice from a couple of our investors. You know, I sort of said, look, I want to be CEO someday. And they all came back to me and said, all right, well, if you want to be CEO, you need to learn sales. And I said, well, but I was VP of sales and marketing. I know sales. They said, no. Sales and marketing in an internet company is a marketing job. You need to go carry a bag. You need to actually go hit a sales quota and go learn what it's like to talk to customers face-to-face and get them to write you checks. And you have a really interesting skill set because you're an engineer, and every sales organization in the world needs somebody who's technical, who can explain the product, and we can get you into one of our portfolio companies and you can go learn this. Well, okay, so sounds great. I'm 32 years old. I've got a colossal ego despite all of the stupid mistakes that I just made over at Big Step. And I'm VP of sales and marketing. I'm coming off being CTO, and these guys want me to go take a director of solutions engineering job working, on a sales force. And it was one of the best things that I ever did. And I'm in a, it's interesting because school ended up being this way for me in a lot of ways too, right? That I got this first job at Apple doing QA, and I was making, $15 an hour or something like that, which back when we were riding dinosaurs was actually a lot of money and, felt great. And I just keep moving up this ladder. And I'm, at no point had I ever stopped and kind of said, hey, what do I want to do? And one day I look up and I'm making a couple $100,000 a year and I'm a VP of engineering. And you can't start over. You can't realize, geez, I don't want to be writing code my whole life. I want to be a product manager. Or I want to be a marketing person, because those are $40,000 a year jobs. And you start all the way over again at the bottom. It's really, really tough. So Big Step was great for me in that it let me make that move from the top of the engineering ladder, fairly high over on the sales and marketing ladder, and pick up some of the skills. But one of the best things that I did, and I, in a lot of ways wish I had done it sooner, was checked my ego, took a job that felt smaller than me because I really needed to go learn. And the I spent 2 years doing a couple of different sales-related jobs. They were definitely not at the compensation level, not with the title, or any of the other things that you sort of, at that point in my career, I expected of myself. I ended up working for a couple of incredibly smart people who taught me a ton about selling. I ended up learning how hard selling is, which is also something, I would recommend, regardless of any field that you ever get into, working in a real sales organization for a year or two, no matter where you ultimately see your track. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal experience because it is just so close to the raw. How does a business actually happen? And where does that friction come from? And as a manager, one of the things that these guys said to me when they put me into this job is, Josh, you're not a sales guy and you're never going to be a sales guy. But if you're going to be a CEO, you're going to manage sales guys. And you got to know how to read a pipeline so that your sales guys can't bullshit you. You got to understand what's really happening in that organization well enough that you can understand and make predictions about your future cash flow. You need to have an understanding of this so that you can help these guys and understand what your role is in parachuting into big deals and helping give air cover to those teams, et cetera. So it was incredibly, incredibly valuable. And it was no question I will, never, ever consider myself a salesperson. I have tremendous, tremendous respect for them. But I think if you can find a way to do a job that you know you're never going to do, but that you're going to be dependent on at some point in your career, it's really, really helpful. And it gives you a really different perspective ultimately when you become more of a general manager and get to sort of manage more broadly. And I got the chance. So from this being out in the field, I get a phone call one day from a guy named Bill Gross, who runs Idea Lab down here in Pasadena. Bill is an absolutely amazing serial entrepreneur savant. I don't even know exactly what to call it. I think he started 60 or 70 different companies. Idea Lab I'll back up and I'll tell you a funny story. Bill started a company called Knowledge Adventure that was a gaming company, and phenomenally successful. And Knowledge Adventure goes public, and they're worth a ton of money. And somebody comes down and finds Bill down in the basement. He's got all these engineers working on all this stuff that has nothing to do with games. He just had all these ideas in his head. So he just, you know, he's the founder. He just keeps grabbing people. And he's like, hey, I want you guys to go work on this thing over here. And, you know, and this board member's looking at it going, Bill, you can't do this. Like, we're a public company. These guys are paid to be building the next big knowledge adventure game. What are you doing here? And a bunch of his board members and friends and advisors sort of said, we got to get this guy out of this company, and we got to build a sandbox for him where he can go play company all day long because he's freaking great at it and he's got these amazing ideas and he sure as hell can't do it trapped inside a single corporate entity. So they literally built Idealab as a platform for this guy to go start companies all day long, and they're great at it. And one of the things that they do that I'm eternally grateful for is they hire people like me to be first-time CEOs. And it's, you know, a training wheel environment to some extent. There's like all this stuff that's done for you as part of that framework that allows you to sort of focus on your product and how do you go to market and the core things instead of, you know, how do I pick a payroll provider? How do I set up a health plan? How do I close the books every month? And really, really useful. So I got my first crack at running a company, and it was very bittersweet. A bunch more stories here that came out. The first one is literally there was a founder of the company that they wanted me to come run. And the founder was the younger brother of the woman who's married to Bill Gross and was the president of Idealab. And this guy who was the founder was somebody that they weren't prepared to let run the company, but they also didn't want to sit him down and have the hard conversation with him because he was family, that he wasn't going to run the company. And I was getting a little bit of a weird vibe as I was going through the whole interview process. And then I'm sitting down talking to Bill's wife as we're, you know, sort of negotiating the final package, and, you know, I get the paperwork and it says president instead of CEO, and I'm thinking, that's weird. I think, you know, the title should be CEO. Well, we don't give CEO immediately. You have to, you know, and it's just like all of these little things that were coming up, and I shouldn't have taken the job. And I knew it at that point in time that this is, you're walking into a situation where these guys need somebody to be the hatchet person. It's not that they believe in you and they have your back and they're investing in you. It's that they have a situation that they've created of their own making and they need somebody to come babysit it. And that's what you're walking into. And I knew it. And I was so desperate to erase all of that failure from Big Step and to get out of having the director of solution engineering title and, you know, and all the rest of it, that again, I sort of, you know, I think, I actually have tremendously fond memories of that company, and I learned a hell of a lot from it. But it was an ego decision in the face of everything telling me, this is a job, don't take it. And I took it. So start working, and I realize very quickly. So Andrew, who was my CEO and co-founder at Big Step, is running another company for Idealab. And Andrew, the guy that I used to go have screaming matches with, was the one who'd gone to Bill Gross and said, you should hire Josh. That guy's ready to be a CEO. And so 6 months into this, and it finally hits me what was going on, why Andrew was 4+1, why he was off doing his own thing. I'm going to these board of directors meetings, and they're crushing me. You know, how come we're not raising money? How come we're not selling faster? How come the next version of the product's not done? And I got Mark, who's supposed to be helping me, but he wasn't all that helpful. And you realize, or I realized, that this is literally the loneliest job in the world, bar none. It doesn't matter if you've got co-founders. If you're the CEO, the difference in the pressure and the expectations that get put upon you are crushing. And the especially first time, I mean, it's almost indescribable how isolating it is, because your partner, spouse don't understand the politics and the dynamics of it. They certainly don't understand how bad you want it. Like, I think it's one of the most impossible things to convey, is when you take that first job, it is such a, you know, unbelievable fulfillment of things that you want, that you almost don't want to admit to yourself if it's not working, because it means so much to you. So 6 months into this, I walked up to Andrew and I apologized to him and I literally said, I'm sorry, I was the biggest asshole. I had no idea how hard this was. And Andrew and I are very, very good friends today, despite the almost punching each other God knows how many times along the way. But it really, it was an incredibly eye-opening thing to realize that, like, this guy wasn't trying to screw his co-founders. This guy wasn't trying to make himself better than us. We just had absolutely no idea the pressure that he was under and what that felt like and how he didn't feel like he could share that or spread that around to everybody else. I learned another really, really tough lesson that goes along with sort of trusting your gut, which is that when you need to fire somebody, you need to fire somebody. And I've talked a lot about how much it sucks to fire people, and it really does. But the other thing that sucks even worse than firing people is keeping people around who need to be fired. And there's a couple of things that pop up in here, especially around the fear. Like, one of the most common things that comes up is, well, I need to find somebody to replace them before I get rid of them. And because otherwise I'm going to have to do it, and I don't have any time for that. And one of the things that we lose sight of very, very quickly is that when you have bad people in your organization, it's often not just that their work's not getting done, it's the impact that they have on the other people around them. And today, when we have a situation like that, generally the first question that I'll sit down with my team and ask is this person doing harm? If they're doing harm, they have to go, even if that means that we have to suck it up and find a way to triage the whole thing. If they're not doing harm, we may have a little more lenience around it. But if they're hurting the rest of the people around them, they have to go. So I'll tell you a funny story, because this was probably when I knew that he had to go, despite the fact that I should have known it, months before. But it's the most disrespectful thing I have ever lived through in my life as a manager. I'm sitting in my staff meeting, and Mark, the founder, is late. And he walks into my staff meeting about 5-10 minutes late, puts down his computer on the desk, grabs his newspaper, and walks back out and goes into the bathroom. And then came back in about 15 minutes later and put the newspaper back down on the table. I fired him a couple of weeks later. I probably should have fired him 6 months earlier. But the guy was a cancer. And it was things like that all the time. And this is, it's the flip side of the it sucks to fire friends. It sucks for the people who are being impacted, who want to be there and want to be a part of your company, want to do good work, to be surrounded by people who are poisoning the environment. And it's always, always difficult, especially with more senior people or people who are taking on a lot of work or people who have been there for a long time that are, have some kind of iconic stature inside the company. And John and I dealt with this recently, a couple of people that we know, and it's one of these things that's fascinating where you agonize and you agonize and you agonize about doing this. What's it going to mean to our culture and all the rest of this? And then you do it, and people start walking up to you going, thank God. I'm so glad that you did that. And you realize that while you were sitting there agonizing about all the thing, the negative impact that it was going to have, there was just this poison spreading all over your company. And most of the people that you will work with in your life want to be successful. Nobody here, I don't know how many jobs you've had yet in your life, nobody gets up in the morning and goes, I want to go to work and hate it today. You're going to spend the next, hopefully for all of you, since you're in an entrepreneurship class, you're going to spend the next 3 years of your life building companies, take them public, and go retire to the Bahamas. But you might end up working for 5 or 6, maybe 8 or 9 along the way in that process. Don't go to work and have it suck. And if you're in charge, don't go to work and let other people have it suck. Get them out of there, and it's your job to manage that. And fear really kicked in here too. This was a job I shouldn't have taken. I worked my butt off. I cared about it tremendously. But it was an incredibly, from the family dynamics, from some of the board dynamics, it was also one of the most poisonous situations I'd ever been in. And I got to a point where I felt like I needed to leave. And it's worth noting at this point that one of the investors that I'd brought into the company had left his venture capital firm, along with one of my other board members, to go start their own firm. And the two of them had been fighting with the Idealab board members basically since the beginning of the company. And so, again, you had this really weird dynamic. Your board really, really matters. It's hard to manage a board. It's an incredibly hard. You don't know, you know, are they your parents that you're bringing your report card home to? Your first board is a disaster no matter what. You know, I've been told by a bunch of people it takes at least three before a CEO knows how to manage a board to actually be effective and contribute to them. Your first one's a disaster, even if they're trying to help you. These guys were not trying to help. Like, these guys were trying to fight with each other about literally everything. And so Robert and Stu leave the board, and this other guy who worked at the VC firm who'd put $10 million into us, you know, joins the board. And so I don't have any of the guys who invested in me involved in this thing anymore. I have this awful, awful environment. And, you know, and they start talking about, you know, maybe Josh should be running product and we're going to bring another CEO in. And they brought in this one guy and he was an absolute idiot and they fired him 30 days later. And meanwhile, I'm just, you know, I'm sitting here like I've got this pile of stock. I've got a couple of years of my life invested in this thing. And I sit down with this new board member who came in to represent the $10 million, and I said, I got to get out of here. Like, these people are crazy. You guys clearly want to go in another direction. You want to go bring in a new CEO. You know, and I'm thinking, I'm talking to a grown-up here, you know, life is good. And he looks at me and he goes, we put the money into you. You leave and you're never going to work in this town again. And so now what do? I hate my job. You know, and I hate my investors. I hate my board member. Every other week, there's some new person coming through interviewing that they're just rubbing in my face that now we're going to make you work for this person. Now we're going to make you, I mean, I'm being insulted constantly in every possible way that you can imagine. I'm literally breaking out in hives, like I'm physically falling apart. I don't know what to do. And all I know is I've spent my entire life wanting to be the CEO of a company, wanting to raise money from venture capitalists, wanting to go build companies. It has turned to absolute and here's the one guy from Silicon Valley up on Sand Hill Road saying to me, if you quit, we'll make sure that you never get to work at another company again. So I stuck it out for 6 months. We went through three different CEOs that they brought in to supervise me. At the end of that, I finally came in and I said, you know, do your worst. I quit. I'm leaving. And they were pretty bad about it, but I left. And slowly but surely, the hives went away. I didn't have any hair left at this point, but the at least, you know, I was just kind of free. And I ended up doing a couple of interesting things. I helped a friend of mine called me up and he said, you know, I know these two guys and they're trying to start this company. They don't know what the hell they're doing, but they're ex-Procter & Gamble guys. They're, you know, they're really smart. They know this space, but they don't know how to set up a company. And the last thing in the world that I wanted was a full-time job at this point. But I started doing their weekly brainstorm phone call with them. And, you know, then Emra, who was living in Cincinnati working at P&G, picked up and he flew out to California. And they raised a little bit of money, and it was getting a little more serious and a little more serious. And I spent what's probably, you know, the most fun 6 months of my life in some ways helping Emra out. I didn't want his job. I didn't want to run his company. I just wanted to help this guy get this company off the ground and sort of rediscover the, you know, I mean, I don't even think I thought of it that way at the time. It was just more like, okay, I got a little bit of money coming in from consulting with these guys, and I don't have to go to work for anybody, and I don't have to go, like, ask for a CEO job and find out that I'm never going to work in this town again, right? So it was a nice little place to go be in denial, probably more than anything else. But what was really cool about it was that Emra was just, like, this incredibly gracious guy who wanted to go start this company. I had now done everything there was to do in a company and had no ego about it for the first time in my life. Idealab and X1 beat every semblance of an ego out of me over the, you know, the course of those couple of years. And so I set up the payroll system one day. I hired the engineering manager the next day. I brought bagels for the engineers, you know, whatever it was that sort of needed to be done. And I was just an extra set of hands for him. And I spent 6 months doing that, helping him out, coaching him through the second round of funding that he raised. Interestingly enough, from the same people who told me I would never work in this town again, put $10 million into them. And they're called Total Beauty. They're thriving. It's a great site if you're into beauty products and beauty supplies. They're a great site. And it was kind of what I needed to, you know, to wash that out of my system and go on to, you know, what became sort of the next chapter in this whole thing. And I'm almost done here, so I'll just I'll point out a couple of sort of interesting things, you know, that I learned. Facebook has these posters up all over their building, and there's, you know, if you go Google, this is a weird thing to say, if you Google Facebook poster, you will find a bunch of these sort of interesting posters that they have up there. But this, they've got a bunch of this kind of wall art that it comes from this. And fundamentally, you know, what I can tell you is, so at this point, you know, whatever, I was 35, 36 years old, and you sort of realize I've been making all of these decisions in my life largely from this place of fear, right? Like fear of failing and not becoming the CEO, fear of letting my company, you know, disappear, fear that I would never work in this town again, fear that my talent wasn't there, you know, fear that people wouldn't follow me, all of those other kind of things. And you kept sort of looking back and going, Jesus, I keep making these stupid-ass decisions and getting myself into these awful places. And every single time I can trace it back to this notion of, I have this notion of who it is that I want to be, and I'm so terrified that I'm not that person that I'm going to get myself into yet another stupid situation to prove that I'm not that person. This is ridiculous. Let's go try to live life a little bit differently. So I went to Yahoo. And Yahoo was like every other big company in a lot of ways. You know, just like the team at Apple that, you know, didn't want to ship the printer for whatever reason, I got to Yahoo and I found all these people who were really, really comfortable in some ways with the idea that we didn't know how to make a decision about anything. And I came in there, you know, very much, I think, with this new breath of fresh air around the idea that I'm not afraid anymore. And that, you know, I'm going to be able to, whatever happens, bounce back. And so there was a, you know, there was a moment, I think, for me where I sat in this meeting and, you know, my title is VP of something and whatever else. And we're talking about something. And I said, okay, well, let's do blah, blah, blah. And somebody sitting in the room said, well, are we allowed to make that decision? And this is very much what it, you know, what it was like at Yahoo at the time. And I just sort of said, you know what? They write me a paycheck. My title says VP on it. Yes, I'm allowed to make that decision. Let's do it. And they're either going to fire me or we're going to get some shit done. And either one of those is okay with me. What's not okay with me is sitting here and not doing something. So let's go. And the most liberating thing in the world. And it is absolutely like, it has changed since then for me absolutely everything about the way that I approach work. And I'd be lying if I said I don't have an ego, that I don't have fears, that I don't worry about whether I'll be successful or not with anything else. But I find myself at least once a month at this point saying the worst they can do is fire me. And the and that's not that bad. You actually recover from it. And if you're going to be an entrepreneur, and you're going to go start companies, if you're going to be somebody who's going to be hyper successful and ambitious and is going to put themselves in a position to be successful, you're going to put yourself in a position to fail. And the because you can't be successful without having something to be the counterbalance to that. And so what I can say to you, and it's easy as hell to say when you're, you know, older and further along and you have a Rolodex and, you know, you have means of recovery and whatever else, is to the extent that you can say the worst thing they can do is fire me and apply that to your life and say what I care about is, can I do good work? Can I be around good people? Can I get stuff done? You will be more successful from that. And it will allow you a freedom to not let yourself get into those situations where people are disrespecting you, where people are keeping you from being able to grow, thrive, and learn. And so The last sort of story that I'll hit on is, so I worked at Yahoo for a couple of years. I ran a big piece of business for them. I went over to Glam. Glam is a company, as John said, that is now a pretty huge global company. It's getting ready to go public next year. Learned a tremendous amount there as well. And then I got the opportunity to go be a CEO again. And Omnicom, which is the parent company of Acuen, called me up. And I had this really nice convergence of, I now knew all this stuff about marketing from Yahoo and Glam, and I had this whole enterprise software background, and marketing is becoming data and technology, and the agencies really need people with that skill set. And, you know, holy happy convergence, right? And I've got, like, bosses who want me to be there and the rest of it. And I stumbled upon this book that Pete Carroll wrote. And it's a little cheesy to bring up a football coach and his book in a meeting like this, but Pete's book was really, really interesting to me because for those of you who don't know his story, incredibly successful assistant coach, wins Super Bowls with the 49ers, gets the chance to go be the head coach in New England, is absolutely abysmal at it, gets run out of town on a rail and fired, and thinks he's never going to work again. And, you know, he got his shot at the brass ring or whatever, and he blew it. And his book begins by talking about getting fired by the Patriots. And the, you know, for those that don't follow football or don't care, I mean, he goes on to become the head coach at USC, take USC on this 10-year odyssey of winning that, you know, is really, really unparalleled. But he wrote, you know, this whole book basically about that sort of dark period of having achieved his, you know, the apex of his life's desire and failed at it, and trying to figure out what do you go do next. And the one thing that his whole book is based on is what he came up with is that he realized that he had gone into every single one of these other jobs in his life without really understanding who he was or what he was about. What he was ultimately about was the ambition of getting that next job, right? And so it wasn't at any point him saying, this is what I want to do. It was just, there's this ladder, there's the next rung, I got to keep climbing, I got to go do this thing. And so while he's fired, he went out and he wrote a philosophy for himself and realized that, you know, kind of for the first time he had the opportunity to sit down and think about who am I and what am I about. And I read that right before I took the job at Acuen, and it was interesting for me because I felt like I knew how his story ended. And I was sort of going into that next chapter of kind of, okay, are you going to be able to go, you know, make it happen this time? And so I did the same exercise, and I went through and I asked myself, you know, what are you about? And I'm not about the same things that Pete Carroll's about. We are very, very different people, and we have very, very different philosophies. But there were a couple of things that were really, really important to me that I felt like I had learned over the course of this whole thing. And I said to myself, okay, so any new company that I'm going to go be the leader of, these are the things that I want to be, I want our company to stand for. One of them, you know, for example, is I really, really care about smart. And the word smart does not show up in Pete Carroll's football book, I guarantee it. However, it is for us at Acuen, one of the things, and I talked about this literally the first time I talked to the whole company, is I want people, when somebody in the industry, anywhere, inside the company, outside the company, says Acuen, I want the first thing that comes to people's mind is those guys are smart. And so let's think about how do we make that part of our culture. Let's think about how do we make that part of how we communicate. And we've done more. Agencies are notorious for not training people, for example. We invest more and we spend more time training not only our employees but all the other employees in the agency. I think I've trained more of them from my little 60-person company than the entire rest of the organization has in the last couple of years. And we just, it's like it becomes this thing where you start saying at every single touch point with us, how can we bring that philosophy to life? And as a leader, you have the opportunity. It doesn't just the CEO who gets to have that philosophy. You get to have that philosophy in how you approach your work, in how you approach your colleagues, in how you approach your customers, in how you approach your vendors and your competition and everything else. And I wish I'd read it earlier. And I recommend it to everybody, despite the fact that, you know, I'm really not that much of a football guy, but I do really recommend that you think about and that you take the time as you go out and approach the world to think about what are the couple of things that I really value that I want to make sure I don't lose along the way. And I lost every single one of them along the way. I mean, I cannot tell you, sitting there waiting for the judge to sign off on my immunity is still the most screwed up morning of my life, bar none. And it came down to, you know, losing sight of that. So really simple, and I'll wrap up here. Mentors matter. The most important things that have happened to me in my life have come because somebody older, smarter, more powerful, whatever else than I was, gave me an opportunity and talked to me and, you know, showed me steps that I could take to go make myself better. Seek them out. The best people in the world love the opportunity to spend time with other people and to show them and help them. And those people make a huge, huge difference. Talked lots and lots and lots about failure. Failure, not only does it happen and it's a part of life, you learn from it just as much as you do from being successful, possibly even more. But what I've learned from it more than anything else is that the worst places that I've gone to in my life have come from being scared about failing. And, you know, when I was 20 years old, I wanted nothing more than to go start a company. I've been chasing that my entire life. I wanted to be, you know, the CEO and everything else that went along with that. And it knocks you all over the place, wanting something that badly and running into setbacks around that. And I think, you know, if I can impart anything there at all, it's that that's okay. Failing means that you're trying to do something hard. And that's always a good thing. Keep learning. At 33, 34 years old, whatever it was, taking the job in sales, going and doing something completely outside my comfort zone, taking a step back was good. My dad's a college professor, so it's a little bit upsetting to him that he has this son that didn't go to college and doesn't think all that much of it, especially because everybody else in the family are PhDs. It's a little bizarre. But the thing that was interesting is that he enrolled me in classes at the college that he taught at when I was in junior high school. Like, I wanted to learn how to make videos, and they had a video production class. So he stuck me in that class. And so it's weird that on one hand, I sort of think of myself as somebody who didn't go to school. And on the other hand, I'm somebody who's taken classes his entire life, whether structured or not structured. When I wanted to learn a new programming language, I went to a junior college and went and did that. And I do think it's really, really important to recognize that, be it structured, be it unstructured, learning is something that goes on for the entire course of your life, and that if you open yourself up to it, even if it's just reading Pete Carroll's book, it is, it's a really, really phenomenal part of growing. And it's something that I think as a culture, we tend to screw up, that we think of education as this chapter in our lives that we go through and we get over with. And, you know, the best thing I can say I took away from that was that my dad taught me that school was always there and that there was always an opportunity to go learn something new and to take advantage of it. And the last thing I'll end on is people, right? So, like, you know, throughout this whole thing, I keep mentioning people's names, right? Like Tom Hammer, the guy that, you know, taught me about learning versus teaching, and Mark, the guy who taught me about not going to the bathroom in the middle of your staff meeting, and, you know, all the rest of this. The people that you work with over the course of your life, the good ones, the bad ones, you know, et cetera, are ultimately going to be the people that create the experiences that really, really matter to you. And the, you know, it is, it is incredibly easy, I think, when you are pushing yourself to succeed and striving and sort of climbing, to miss that part of it. And, you know, whether it's not taking the time when you call from the road to realize that your cold duck wasn't the, you know, the most important thing going on that night, whether it's the not having, you know, the ability to see that Andrew is going through this unbelievably difficult thing and you're making it harder on him by putting even more pressure on him instead of, you know, looking for ways that you can help, whatever else. Almost everything for me at this point in my life comes back to that, and ultimately as a manager becomes where I manage from. And I'm spending almost all of my time at this point thinking about how do I understand what other people are going through, and how do I streamline that or make that easier for them, or somehow position something, talk about something, put into context something in a way that this person is going to be able to understand it, and recognizing that many of those people are in fact going through those same kind of places of fear or lack of control that caused me to do things that in hindsight I don't want to do. And it's I think it's one of the most interesting things about business ultimately at the end of the day, that starting companies, running companies, is about getting other people to follow you, getting about people to believe in you, to execute your vision. And it's ultimately about getting people who are really, really different from you, who are motivated by different things, who learn in different ways, who execute their tasks in different ways, to work together and to do something as a coherent whole. And you can't do that if you can't see other people and you can't see their differences and you can't respect those differences, as opposed to being upset by the fact that they don't do it the way that you do or as fast as you do or whatever else. And ultimately, it's those people and those relationships, even the ones that I fired, that I go out drinking with still to this day. We have reunions, that is what is, at the end of the day, going to be your life and your legacy. And so make the people part of it be the best part. And that's it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.